We welcome New York Post theater columnist Michael Riedel to the roundtable this morning with the publication of his second book, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. With over 150 insider interviews, Singular Sensation portrays the people, money, and power that created the blockbuster show's an aesthetic spectacle that has dominated not only a couple of acres of real estate in the heart of Manhattan, but has also captured the hearts and minds of millions of people around the world.
I wanna be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I wanna be a producer, lunch at Sardi's every day. I wanna be a producer, sport a top hat and a cane. I wanna be a producer and drive those chorus girls insane.
Michael Riedel has been the theater columnist for the New York Post since 1998. His first book, Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway, was a New York Times bestseller. And it's a great pleasure to welcome him back to the roundtable this morning. Michael, congratulations on the new book, and thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thanks, Joe, and good to be with you, too. And, God, this book is sort of bittersweet here because the subtitle was The Triumph of Broadway. And I finished the book in February, and it's about Broadway in the 90s when Broadway became, kind of a major part of American popular culture again with Rent and Angels in America and Chicago and The Lion King and The Producers. And I lived through that whole era. I covered all those shows, and I thought, my God, Broadway is really back, better than ever. And I finished this book in February, and I went skiing in Italy, and I took a picture. I'll never forget this, Joe, as long as I live. I took a picture of a glass of wine I was having at the base of the Matterhorn, and I texted it to my girlfriend, and she said, "Where are you?" And I said, "I'm in Italy skiing." And she said, "Do you understand what's going on in northern Italy right now? The coronavirus is spiking." And I got back, 4 days later, and New York was shut down, and Broadway was shut down. And we all thought that Broadway would be shut down for maybe 2 weeks, 4 weeks, and 8 months into this thing, Broadway is still closed and has no hope of coming back until, I think, 2022. So The Triumph of Broadway, as the subtitle of my book, is kind of ironic, which I never intended it to be.
I obviously want to talk about the book, but while we're talking about where we are now, let us stay there for a moment. As you indicated, I think maybe a month and a half, 2 months ago, there was some hope that spring of 2021 was a possibility. And now with the spike and yes, there is good news about a vaccine, but it's still, I think, to your point of 2022 as being more realistic. And You even speculate in the foreword to the book, which you wrote, I believe, in May, which is basically saying, how do you come back from this? This is a tourist industry. How do you bring people back to a city after this cataclysmic event, a global pandemic, and have people trust and say, okay, this is where I want to go and this is how I want to spend my money?
It's going to be tough. There's no question about it. I think the way you do it, I was talking to Rocco Landisman, who's a big character in my book. Rocco ran Jude Jansen Theaters back in the 90s, a very colorful character. And I was talking to him last night, and he said, look, once you get the vaccine, you're going to have to, and here's the key thing, you're going to have to say to people, okay, Broadway got a little bit too greedy, a little bit too rich. And you were charging people $1,000 to see Hamilton. Those premium prices, those kind of prices on Broadway, they got out of control, I think. And Rocco and I are on the same page here, where when we can open Broadway again, and there's a vaccine, and people feel safe getting together, you have to lower the ticket prices on Broadway. You cannot reopen Broadway and say, hey, we're back in business, and we still want you to pay $1,000. That's not going to happen. Got to restructure the whole finances of the theater world to say, be brave, come back. We know you love the theater. We know that Broadway is, one of the fundamental things that makes New York, New York, and now it is going to be affordable for everybody. So take the chance, and the tickets for Hamilton are not going to be $1,000. Frankly, I think they should be $75. I think they should be $100, just to bring people back until people feel safe to congregate again. Broadway cannot be what it was before the pandemic. It cannot be for the 1%. It has to reopen itself. It has to rethink about where it's going and say, we can only exist because of everybody who wants to go to the theater can afford to go to the theater and feel safe. The only good thing about this pandemic, and there are very few, well, there's nothing good about this pandemic, but the only thing that I think that we can get out of this is that those ticket prices on Broadway can be lowered to a point where most people, as I was a kid here in New York as a student, can afford to go see a Broadway show. Frankly, Broadway was getting too greedy for its own good, I thought, before the pandemic.
Will it have an impact on the smaller shows? I mean, you write in this book so much about The Lion King and Rent, of course, and Chicago and the producers that you mentioned, and the producers really being one of the first shows to implement a policy where you could get a really good ticket, but you were going to pay a lot of money for it. So what about the smaller shows and the plays that come on Broadway, and what challenges do they face?
Well, actually, I think smaller shows might be a good place for us to begin to restructure the whole theater world, because if you're in a small theater, you only have, you know, like a handful of people. Listen, you know, over the years, Joe, I went to a bunch of off Broadway shows, and there were like 10 people in the house, but you saw something interesting, something unique, something kind of fun. And I do think that the corporatization of Broadway that happened in the 90s, that's kind of over with right now. And you're going to have a lot of empty theaters when Broadway comes back. And I think you should start, if I were a theater owner, if I were the Schuberts or the Nederlanders who own all those Broadway theaters, let's experiment. Let's take these great theaters that are right here in Times Square in New York City, and let's experiment and let's play around with kind of new ideas for theater, new voices that we may never have given a chance, because we could have booked the new Disney show. We could have booked the new Andrew Lloyd Webber show. But let's take a chance and book a show by somebody that, you know, might be a little offbeat, might be a little weird, that would have been off Broadway.
Yeah.
Let's put them in this theater, and we can social distance and space things out. And let's, you know, have a vibrancy to the art form of theater again. I mean, that's the only hope that I have that comes out of this pandemic, that, you know, new artists rise up and the theater structure, the power players on Broadway realize we have to open ourselves up, not to just the movie that's now been made into a musical, the corporate show that's coming in. Let's open it up for some experimental stuff going on. And that could lead to a whole new kind of theater in America.
Michael Riedel is our guest. The name of the new book is Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. So segueing to the book and exactly to what you were just talking about, that's what happened where this book starts up where your last book left off in the late 90s. And Rent was a show that came from off-Broadway, and nobody thought it was going to be what it was. It was something new, and they played around, and they took a shot on something that became a meteor.
Yeah, it's very interesting, because back in those days, this is going back to the early 90s, and we still had the kind of the British invasion, we called it. You know, the Andrew Lloyd Webber, the right. Cameron Mackintosh, he was a great producer of those shows. We had Cats, Phantom of the Opera, Les Miserables, Miss Saigon. Those shows cost a gazillion dollars. And then Andrew did Sunset Boulevard, which, by the way, I have to say is a great show, but it was wildly overproduced. It was so expensive, and it just kind of collapsed on itself. It was too expensive to keep going. And Andrew Lloyd Webber, he wins the Tony Award in 1995 for Best Musical, because there's nothing else on Broadway but Smokey Joe's Cafe, which was a review of the songs of Lieber and Stoller. So there was really nothing going on Broadway right then but Andrew Lloyd Webber. But just as Andrew is winning his Tony Award in 1995, this kid that no one has ever heard of before, Jonathan Larson, is writing this musical about his life. about his friends. He's writing about what it is like to live in New York City in the early 90s when your friends are dying of AIDS, they may be addicted to drugs, they're artists struggling, and yet New York is being gentrified, and you know, the one bedroom apartment you could afford is suddenly going to be so expensive that you have to move out of it and you have no place to go. He is writing about that. And, you know, it's a sadness in the book. When Jonathan Larson finished Rent and it had its dress rehearsal that night off Broadway at the New York Theater Workshop, and he was not feeling well that night, but he saw his show. He saw his show finally come together for that dress rehearsal. And after that dress rehearsal, he went home to his walk-up apartment, you know, shabby little apartment. I've actually been to that apartment, pretty shabby place. And he put a tea kettle on, and he dropped dead on his kitchen floor of an aneurysm. And he never lived to see what Rent created. And the switch there was that suddenly with Rent, Broadway was young. It had rock music again. It was a young cast of people we'd never heard of before. I mean, one, Idina Menzel, we know her now, you know, but we did not know her then. Taye Diggs, we know him now. We did not know him then. And everything shifted right then. With the success of Rent, that sadly Jonathan did not live to see, that inspired a whole generation of writers to write for Broadway. Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote Hamilton, he saw Rent 30 times as a kid. He would not be in the musical theater today but for Rent. Bobby Lopez, who wrote Avenue Q and The Book of Mormon, Bobby would not have been there but for the fact that he saw Rent as a kid, and he went back to see it 10 times. So Rent shifted everything, and the whole point of my book is that at that moment in time, Broadway suddenly becomes something else. It becomes American again, because, you know, Andrew Lloyd Webber was British and Cameron Mackintosh was British, and they kind of dominated Broadway in the 80s. But in the 90s, the Americans come back and they take charge of the great American musical. And that really could not have happened, I think, without Jonathan Larson's contribution with Rent. And it's a knife in the heart when you think that that kid, Jonathan, never lived to see what he changed.
You point out that spring, at $3.5 million, Rent was the cheapest musical on Broadway. Victor Victoria star Julie Andrews came in at $15 million, and Big, based on the hit Tom Hanks film, had a budget of $10 million. That was what it was up against.
Right. And it defeated every single one of those shows. And the only show we're still talking about today is Rent.
So what does it say, and what did Rent allow, and you write about this, that allowed Broadway to do and to take chances, and how it changed the future and it changed the environment, which it did. But it also, as we pointed out in the beginning of the conversation, it also ushered in this corporatization.
Well, what happened with Rent, and you know, this is something I'm trying to grapple with in my book. With a show like Rent, it captured the cultural moment. And so everybody started to, all the, you know, the powerful people in the entertainment business, they said, wow, this thing called Rent in New York City on Broadway is exploding in a big, big way. And all these corporations began to think, well, we have to come to Broadway now because there's some money to be made on Broadway. I mean, if you think about Rent, if you and I had invested, let's say, you know, the initial capitalization of Rent off-Broadway was $150,000. Rent went on to gross about $2 billion around the world. I mean, that's a pretty good return for your investment. So all these corporations started to think, wow, there's some money to be made here on Broadway. So Disney comes in. That was the first one that came in. Disney comes in. They do Beauty and the Beast, which frankly I don't think is a great show. And we were all concerned that Disney was going to take over Broadway and make it into a theme park. But they made a lot of money on Beauty and the Beast. But things were changing. You know, you had to be a little more creative, a little more artistic. So Michael Eisner, Michael told me, he said, you know, we did Beauty and the Beast, and frankly, you know, we got knocked by the critics. And I thought, if we're going to do something else on Broadway, we have to be a little more inventive. He said, well, we're going to do The Lion King. But how do we do The Lion King in a way that people won't criticize us as being just a, you know, a company that does theme park shows on Broadway? And Tom Schumacher, who is now the head of Disney Theatrical, Tom was working for Michael Eisner at the time, and Tom said, you know what, if you really want to push it a little further, let's hire Julie Taymor. And Julie Taymor was this avant-garde artist who did these, frankly, weird things with puppets. I mean, you know, she lived in Indonesia and Bali, and she was doing all this weird puppetry. And I saw everything that Julie had done. I went to every Julie show back in the day. It was off-Broadway, off-Broadway. And it was beautiful. I mean, her stuff was beautiful, but it was weird. I have to say, it was weird. So Tom Schumacher says to Michael Eisner, let's hire Julie Taymor. And Julie Taymor, who had never seen The Lion King before, and in my book, I interviewed her, and she says, you know, I didn't really watch those Disney cartoons. That's what she called them. But she looked at The Lion King cartoon and thought, you know, there's something here. There's a kind of majesty about a boy who has to replace his father. You know, Simba has to replace Mufasa, the Lion King. There was something kind of fundamental that she found. And she began to design this kind of puppetry on a big scale that Disney could pay for. And it was weird. And I show in my book, I write in my book that the Disney executives, they saw one of her workshops and like, this is too weird for us. I mean, we got these puppets on the head. Do we look at the actors' faces?
Right.
This is too weird. We got to pull the plug on this thing. You know, it's not going to work. Not going to work. But they kind of stuck with it. And Joe, this is the most exciting moment in my life in theater. I went out to Minneapolis where The Lion King was having its tryout at the Orpheum Theater. And I was prepared to kill it. I thought there is no way that Disney and Julie Taymor can come together. And I thought, this is going to be a disaster. And I sat there. I'm totally true story. I sat there with my arms folded, like, and my pen dipped in poison, ready to destroy Disney and Julie Taymor. And I saw, you know, C.D. LaLoca, she was playing Rafiki. The beginning of the circle of life. And the sun rose up. It was simple. It was nothing but paper and bamboo. But it rose up so brilliantly lit by Don Holder. And then these giraffe puppets, I mean, these guys as giraffes came loping out. And then a cheetah puppet came out. And I thought, I have no words to describe what I am seeing here right now. And I was stunned. And all of a sudden, something brushed up against me. And it was the ear of the giant elephant puppet walking down the aisle of the Orpheum Theater in Minneapolis. And at the end of that opening number of the Circle of Life for The Lion King, 1,500 people in Minneapolis were standing on their seats screaming and cheering. And to my great shame, as cynical a critic as I can be, I was one of those people standing on my seat cheering. I had never seen anything as exciting as that in my life. And Disney went with Julie Taymor, and today the worldwide gross for The Lion King, not the movie, but the stage production of The Lion King, stands at $10 billion, making it the most successful entertainment property of all time.
And the good news for you is you could use that poison ink years later when Julie Taymor did Spider-Man.
Well, yes. It's sad to say I became friendly with Julie, but then I took that poison pen and stabbed her right in the back when I destroyed Spider-Man, turn off the dark. I mean, it's kind of incredible, though. You think of Julie Taymor, and she is a genius, and I love her. I mean, I've had my ups and downs with her over the years, but I love her to death because she's one of the great artists in, I think, in the 20th century. But that the fact that she can do The Lion King, the most successful show on Broadway of all time, and then do Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, the biggest flop in the history of Broadway of all time, tells you how extreme Julie can swing.
Michael Riedel is our guest. He is the author of the new book, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway, and is also the theater columnist for the New York Post. Are you still on furlough from that job?
Yeah, I am, sadly. Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, the best of my life, like you, Joe, I went into the radio. I host the morning show with my old friend Len Berman, the sportscaster. Len and I do Len Berman and Michael Riedel in the morning on 710 WOR. And I took that job about 2.5 years ago thinking I needed to do something else. You know, I was kind of, what more can I write about Broadway? I've seen all the great stuff. I've written a couple of books on it. Maybe it's time to figure out something else to do in life. And I was lucky that I got the job hosting the morning radio show. And thank God I did, because I would be out of work and unemployed with no income had I not gone into the radio.
So there are three things that I want to talk to you about. We have limited time, but I want to touch on them because I found them to be fascinating. One is you have a chapter in the book talking about the power of Rosie O'Donnell. And this ties into Lion King as well, of her popular television show and what she was able to do for Broadway, which is really fascinating if you think about it.
Yeah, you know, so this book is about the 90s on Broadway. And as I was putting it together, I remembered, so the 90s, Broadway became really big business in the 90s. And I was a big fan of the old Ed Sullivan shows. I was not alive when he was on. I'm not that old. But I used to watch them on YouTube. I still watch them on YouTube. And it occurred to me that Rosie O'Donnell was kind of the Ed Sullivan of the 90s. Ed Sullivan used to have all the Broadway shows on his very popular CBS show back in the 50s and the 60s. And Rosie kind of recaptured that. And she loved Broadway. And she would put on her show all the Broadway shows. She would go to Broadway that night. The next morning, she would say to her viewers, and there were 7 million of them, and mainly women. And by the way, women buy the tickets on Broadway. You know, men don't buy tickets to Broadway. Women buy tickets to go to see a show, and they drag their husbands with them. And Rosie would be there in the morning. She'd say, I saw the show last night, and it was terrific. And she drove ticket sales in a way that no one had driven ticket sales since probably, you know, Frank Rich, the New York Times critic back in the 1980s. And Rosie kind of became the ambassador for Broadway to mainstream America. She made a lot of these shows. She made The Lion King, Titanic, a show I cover in my book, Chicago. She talked about those shows on her show. She had the cast members on. They sang songs from the shows. And she really kind of helped put Broadway front and center into mainstream popular culture. And kind of the tragedy of all that is that then Rosie decided she wanted to be a Broadway producer herself, and she produced this musical called Taboo starring Boy George, and it was a complete fiasco and lost $10 million, all of it that she put up. And I was one of the people who, frankly, put the knife in it. And, well, she's never forgiven me for that.
You also write, you have a chapter in here about Edward Albee and the show Three Tall Women, which we've been obviously concentrating a lot on musicals, but what a great show, but an interesting story of how it came about and found its success.
Well, you know, Joe, I'm glad you single that out, because of all the interviews I've done, you're the only interviewer who's picked up on that chapter, and it's my favorite chapter in the whole book. It was the one I enjoyed writing the most, called Who's Afraid of Edward Albee. I knew Edward. I knew him very well. I was in college, and he taught a class I took, and we became friends. And Edward Albee, who wrote Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and A Delicate Balance, magnificent American plays, he was down and out for the count. He had a bunch of failures on Broadway, and nobody would touch Edward Albee. he was like one of those washed out old writers that you would not even think about anymore. And he had this very contentious relationship with his mother that I write about in the book. And then she died, and he decided to write a play about her. And I remember talking to him at one point, and I said, how could you write about your mother, whom you hated so much? I mean, they had a terrible, terrible relationship. And he said, you know, I hated my mother for so long. And then as she got older and I had to take care of her, I tempered my hatred with something, and that something was pity. And then he began to understand her struggles, her problems. And he wrote this play about her called Three Tall Women that nobody, Joe, nobody in New York would touch. Nobody was interested in Edward Albee. It was done up in Westchester, New York, at a small theater. And a Broadway producer saw it and thought, this is a great play. Brought it to New York at a small off-Broadway theater. And Edward Albee, having been down and out for the count, won the Pulitzer Prize for Three Tall Women. And then he came back in a huge way. And there were magnificent revivals of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and A Delicate Balance on Broadway. And, you know, toward the end of his life, Edward wrote a play called The Goat or Who is Sylvia? Right. A very strange but very interesting play on Broadway. And the audience, it was about a man, an architect, who falls in love with a goat. I mean, he literally falls in love with a goat and brings it home to his wife, and she goes crazy. And the audience went bonkers. And that play still won the Tony Award and won another Pulitzer Prize for Edward Albee. He still had the power at 78 years old to shock an audience. And it was just an amazing comeback, for a great, great American writer.
I want to talk to you our time comes to a close here. I've always found it to be fascinating. I saw the producers for the first time, I think maybe a week and a half after 9/11. And yep. I was so struck by it. And of course it was amazing. And it was Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane in the Mel Brooks classic. And then a while later, I had the chance of seeing it in Los Angeles with Jason Alexander and Martin Short. And I realized, I was wondering, it just didn't seem as good to me. And I didn't know what had happened. And you touch on this in the book, that, and I didn't realize that it went into such detail, but that was a really good show for two very good actors that then had trouble afterward, didn't it?
Yeah, you know, the producers, Mel Brooks' show, it's a terrific show. I mean, it really, it's a great American musical comedy, but it was at a level with Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane that you cannot approach anywhere. Matthew and Nathan, they had chemistry in the way that, you know, I don't know, you know, Johnny Carson and Ed McMahon had chemistry. You can't really program that stuff. There was something about that show and something about Matthew and Nathan and their personalities and their performances where it was just the most joyous thing you could see on stage. And they became so big and they became so identified with that show. I mean, you know, Mel would kill me if he heard this interview, but I have to say, Mel, I love you, Mel Brooks, but Matthew and Nathan kind of overtook you in the producers.
Yeah.
And once those two guys left the show, as good as the show is, and it's a terrific show, you could never recapture the chemistry that Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane had on that stage. And I know, I mean, I was there for opening night, and you thought, this is what theater is all about. These two great actors are having such fun being with each other, and you felt privileged to be let in on the fun that they were having together. And, you know, sadly for the producers, they never found that combination again. But, you know, listen, Joe, that's showbiz. I mean, you know, you hit it for a moment, you capture it in time, and then it's gone. That's the theater.
Well, it is the theater, but yet you have shows, of course, that have just iconic performances that have been able to go on and find further life. and because the material is so damn good.
Yeah. I mean, I do think at some point somebody will revive the producers on Broadway, and they will find the right combination of the new Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane.
Yeah.
They will find that down the line. But, you know, at that moment in time, God, I mean, you're taking me back. I mean, I remember that opening night and the way Matthew and Nathan looked at each other. Those guys, and I try to capture it in my book, those guys, they knew what they were doing, and they knew that what they were doing was gold.
What, just to go back to where we started in the COVID-riddled Broadway scene, what did we miss? A lot of shows that were supposed to open that didn't. A lot of shows that had dates that didn't, and maybe won't ever now. What did we miss?
Well, I think the big one to miss was Patti LuPone in Stephen Sondheim's great revival of Company.
Yeah.
His great musical. And I did catch Patti in that, singing the Elaine Stritch song, Here's to the Ladies Who Lunch. And Patti was terrific. And, you know, I caught that show 2 days before Broadway was shut down. And frankly, I'm not sure that kind of a show can reopen when Broadway comes back. But I am cheered by the fact that I've been in touch with Hugh Jackman, who's going to do Music Man, directed by Jerry Zaks on Broadway. And I've been in touch with Jerry and Hugh. And they're both like, when this thing is over with, we are planning to go into rehearsal in October of 2021. And with any luck, if there's a vaccine, I do believe that Broadway will reopen around February 2022 with Hugh Jackman in The Music Man, leading the parade down Broadway and telling the world we're back in business. And, you know, to me, for Hugh Jackman leading the parade down Broadway, it doesn't get much better than that.
No, and especially with Sutton Foster to side, not bad at all.
Yeah.
Well, it is a fascinating book, and it's just been lovely talking to you. It's Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. It is published by Avid Reader Press. Michael, I'm a great fan of the book and a great fan of your work, and I thank you very much for taking so much time with us.
Anytime, Joe. Call me anytime.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, okay. The name of the book is Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Michael Riedel is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. You're not-